Hello and welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. With me, your host, Ethan Clow, and we're broadcasting here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, the campus community radio station of UBC. Well, welcome to the show on this Friday morning. So good morning to everyone who is listening live. And if you're listening by a podcast, well, welcome to the show wherever you are. So alert listeners know that we took a bit of a two-week hiatus this month. Our last live show was on the 12th, which featured an interview with the HAV Culinary Training Society, which, of course, was fantastic, and I hope you liked it. We took next week off to recharge our batteries and get more content for the show ready. And then when we went to go live on the 26th, well, we had a bit of a technical problem. Yes, I think it was gremlins, or perhaps goblins, I'm not sure. But they got into the system and they caused a bit of haywire mistakes, that kind of thing. And so we only were able to air part of the show on that Friday afternoon. And it was kind of a truncated, mixed up, chopped up episode, so you didn't really get the full content. Now, we're going to correct that this week. On today's show, we're going to re-air some of that content because it's great and we want to make sure that it gets out there, as well as a bit of new stuff peppered in as well to keep things fresh and updated. So sit back and join us here on The Sector, our very first show in October, as it were, October 3rd. And boy, does time fly or what? But anyway, episode 22 of The Sector begins now. So the big news on the international scene was the Scottish independence referendum that occurred on Thursday the 18th. So we did our show a couple days before that last time. So we have the results, and I'm sure you've already heard this, but Scotland voted to stay in the United Kingdom, so it will remain the UK and not England, Wales, and Northern Ireland, and then Scotland sort of with an asterisk. No, Scotland remains a part of the UK. So interesting. I mean, the lead-up polls indicated that the yes, the side that was voting for independence, was actually in the lead. Of course, we got a bit of a different result when the vote actually happened. The numbers were about 55.3% in favor of staying and 44.7% for leaving the UK. So a pretty big disparity between what the initial polls suggested, which actually had the yes side ahead by a few points, in this case, kind of resoundingly defeated by the no side. I think a lot of people were suggesting that it was going to be a lot closer than it actually turned out to be. So why did that happen? I mean, it's hard to really get into it in detail. I mean, obviously, we're not in the UK, so we can't really give you a perfect view of the political landscape. But I think a more interesting question, of course, is how this move for independence relates to some of the common themes that we talk about on this show, including the idea of political organization, for lack of a better term. Oftentimes, we discuss this in view of whether it's better to have a federalized, larger institution, government, state that institutes a kind of stability and a kind of commonality amongst the nation and the people and the citizens, versus a more decentralized approach where authority is vested more in smaller units of government, whether it's civic or provincial, or in America, for example, with states. I mean, it's an argument that's been happening, it's been playing out in our political system for the last, 200 years. So it's no surprise that this again sort of brings that to the forefront. But it is an interesting way to look at it. I mean, we can also take that conversation and extend it a bit further and talk a bit about something that we've discussed here on the show in terms of responsibility, in terms of sort of a social safety net. Is it better to have a government-sponsored system in place, a social safety net, if you will, whether it's healthcare or insurance or something else, that allows us to be a little bit less in terms of freedom, but more in terms of protection? Or do we want a society that's more libertarian, that's more liberal with a person's autonomy and ability to do things, even though they might be dangerous. You know, the classic example, of course, is riding a bike without a helmet. It's certainly safer to ride with a helmet, and it makes a lot of sense to have laws in place to make you ride with a helmet, but at the same time, perhaps something is lost in society when you are, you know, forced to wear a helmet. If you want to wear one, that's great, but if you don't, should you face a fine or a ticket or, you know, a more serious legal concern? Or, you know, if you don't wear a helmet, should you be exempt from the medical coverage that the, you know, the taxpayer fronts to, you know, stitch your head back together when you have a crash? So the Scottish independence, I mean, we can look at it in many different ways, and it offers some very interesting analogies to Canada as well. One aspect that's worth talking about is the role that demographics played in the vote. In fact, it's been said that a independent Scotland was stolen from the youth by the elders of Scotland. And that's kind of true, because the older generations in Scotland voted overwhelmingly to stay part of the UK. Whereas the young, I mean, not necessarily as overwhelmingly in the same sense, but the yes side was more popular with the youth. So why was that? What were some of the impacts for demographic voting in the Scottish referendum? Now, we can see that older Scots from the age of 50 and up voted more in favor of staying with the Union than voting for an independent Scotland. And the narrative behind this, of course, is, well, people in that age group are more concerned with things like pensions and the National Healthcare Service. What's interesting, of course, is that this narrative is not the only story. In fact, about 51% of people aged 16 to 24 also voted no. So it wasn't as though it was simply a question of the elderly stealing an independent Scotland from the youth. In fact, a good deal of young people also voted to stay in the Union. Now, indeed, the biggest supporters of the no were the voters over the age of 65, with two in every three preferring to stay within the United Kingdom. About 55% of the 60 to 65-year-olds and about 53% of the 40 to 59-year-olds also backed the Better Together campaign. Interestingly enough, only the 25 to 39 age group voted yes to leave the UK. And of course, what we mean by that is that that's the only age group that overwhelmingly voted yes. Now, of course, that's an interesting question, because why would that age group be more inclined to vote yes rather than no? Of course, one of the things that indicated there was a preference to voting for the independent Scotland was that youth underemployment or lack of employment itself were all major predictors. So one thing that we can look at here is that we have a group of people, 25 to 39, who are at this point, they should be at this point in their careers in an established place. Of course, in reality, in what we know from everywhere, basically, this age group is actually in a pretty rough state in terms of financial independence, in terms of financial stability, in terms of finding a career and being able to stay with that career. So it's no surprise that this is a group that would show a lot of pessimism towards the UK. Now, I mean, why would the other demographics choose to stay? Well, I mean, there's many different reasons. Obviously, for someone, a senior, the National Healthcare Service is a big reason. Your pension is a big reason to want to stay. For the youth, I mean, who knows? Maybe they're a bit more optimistic. Maybe they aren't experiencing the same kind of economic downturn that a lot of sort of 20-somethings were experiencing here and abroad. Well, why don't we take a break here on The Sector, and we'll return with more nonprofit social justice talk and discussion after this.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
Your station has a lot of problems.
Tell me about it. Just look at our morning guy.
Hello, this is Mole Man in the Morning. Good Mole Man to you. Today, part 4 of our series of the agonizing pain in which I live every day.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, not the home of Mole Man in the Morning. We are back on the sector with me, Ethan Clow, discussing the nonprofit world here on CITR. Well, so we just discussed the results from the Scottish referendum, and again, very fascinating stuff on demographics, and we'll come back to that later on in the show. But for now, it's time for some nonprofit news. So some interesting things have popped up in the last 2 weeks. Thought that I should mention to you guys, our listeners, and hopefully provoke some interesting discussion. Now, the first one is on the question of environmentalists. Now, we all know that environmentalists are a tricky lot. They're wily, they're a little bit sneaky. But did you know that environmentalists pose a bigger threat to Canada than religious extremists? Yeah, I know. That is according to the RCMP. In a report that was obtained via an access to information request, the Canadian law enforcement organization, the RCMP, suggested that we have more to fear from criminal activity of environmentalists than we do from religious-inspired terrorism. Now, ironically, this is sort of true because religious-inspired terrorism is remarkably rare. I mean, I know with the news and 9/11 and the kind of fear society that we have, this sounds ludicrous to say, but in reality, you're much more likely to, you know, die in a plane crash than you are to be blown up by terrorists. It's just, that's the way it is. But because of sort of the news cycle, we have this perception that there's a terrorist behind every tree, when in fact there isn't, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, the point being, though, is that the idea that an environmentalist who might use a method to advocate or to engage in activism that borders on criminal activity is more of a threat than religious extremism can be a bit of a stretch. To quote from the article, the Canadian law enforcement and security intelligence community have noted a growing radicalized faction of environmentalists who advocate the use of criminal activity to promote the protection of the natural environment. That's the most benign form of warning I've ever heard in my life. I mean, honestly, the notion that radicalized environmentalists are engaging in criminal activity to promote the protection of the natural environment, I don't know, is that really a threat to Canadian society and people in this country? If a group of environmentalists, you know, chain themselves to trees to prevent loggers from chopping them down, or, you know, they block a highway so that you can't build a pipeline or something, it's inconvenient, and it may be technically breaking the law, but does that make them dangerous? I don't think so. Now, of course, the takeaway from this, and given sort of the recent landscape in terms of charities and politics and the CRA and the radicalization of rhetoric coming from institutions like the RCMP and the government about environmentalists, this is kind of concerning. I mean, this, after all, is the same authority that we saw things like comparing environmentalists to terrorists. So it's not really a huge surprise that there is this discord there. It's a bit disturbing, though. I mean, we don't have the same reaction to the idea of big business coming in and building oil refineries or resource extraction that really damages the environment can make our health worse by getting, you know, chemicals and noxious fumes in the atmosphere that can poison food and water supplies. Surely those things are more dangerous than somebody, you know, a hippie chaining themselves to a tree somewhere. I mean, just look at some of the recent environmental concerns. There was the major dam burst here in BC that, like, poisoned a huge water supply. It's hard to believe that the environmentalists are the ones who are the dangerous ones here. I think the more accurate thing would be that the people that they're protesting against have the potential to be far more damaging to the natural environment and potentially to the health and welfare of Canadians. And yet, of course, that's not necessarily on the radar of the RCMP. In the same article, it cites how the RCMP have been recently targeting ordinary citizens who protest in demonstrations and rallies. They've actually become targets of surveillance based on the notion that these people could be radical activists in waiting. Like, they're you know, almost like they're terrorists who have snuck into the country or something. It's a little bit disturbing to think that this is how law enforcement is looking at people who are, you know, peacefully, for the most part, peacefully protesting, expressing their rights to be citizens and to be informed citizens. A little bit scary. So what do you think, listeners? Do you believe that these environmentalists are potentially more dangerous than religiously inspired terrorism? Let us know. Give us a shout here on The Sector. We'd like to hear your opinion on this. You can visit us online at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, or you can visit us on Facebook, facebook.com/sectorpodcast. And of course, we're on Twitter at sectorpodcast, and I'm on Twitter at Ethan Clow. So communicate with us your views on this matter. You can also email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. Let us know. Maybe you've been radicalized and you want to explain why and, you know, answer for your endangerment of our business environment. So let us know. We'd be glad to hear from you. Staying on the topic of authority figures and coming down hard on the nonprofit charitable sector, once again, the notion of the CRA and the supposed neutral crackdown on charities is an ongoing discussion in the nonprofit world. Recently, it's come to light that the CRA, the Canadian Revenue Agency, has been auditing various charities in Canada as a result of a crackdown to catch these charities that are improperly engaging in political advocacy. Now, a lot of the charities that are being audited, of course, happen to be very critical of our current conservative government. We're talking about organizations that are environmentalists, organizations like Amnesty International, human rights charities, these sorts of things. Now, I think previously on the show, we talked about the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives and their difficulty with being audited by the CRA. Now, the CRA, of course, has defended themselves, saying that this is entirely apolitical. There's no political motivation at all behind this, on and on and on and they go. And again, that could be true. But what's interesting, of course, is that there doesn't appear to be many conservative charities being audited. Take, for instance, the Fraser Institute, which is a right-wing libertarian think tank that operates here in BC. Now, according to recent reports, the Fraser Institute has been patronaged by a number of high-profile conservatives from America, the Koch brothers, David and Charles Koch, who have donated quite large amounts of money to the Fraser Institute. Now, these two, of course, were also responsible for a number of conservative right-leaning ad campaigns in America, some of which were remarkably iffy in terms of fact presentation and in terms of its honesty to the American public. So it's a bit concerning to see that these fellows are also supporting the Fraser Institute, which frequently releases new reports on economic and government-related concerns. specifically focusing on a urge for smaller government. So this kind of relates back to the question of Scottish independence. They're on the side of looking for a smaller government, less powerful federally. I guess you could say more focused locally, but that also remains to be seen. Now, what's important to remember about the Fraser Institute is that they are an intensely political activity. In fact, that was the label that Rabble gave the Fraser Institute, quote, Canada's most intensely political organization. They are a registered nonprofit, and they are focused on economic and public policy. They often put out what is seen as controversial research, which they seem to support and endorse, which is fine. Now, of course, they're also a charity, and this would imply that they're under the same regulations as every other charity in Canada, like Amnesty International or the David Suzuki Foundation or the Center for Policy Alternatives. So, surely the Fraser Institute must be on the radar of the CRA for an investigation into their political activity. But it appears that the Fraser Institute has not been questioned. In fact, they seem to have flown completely under the radar of the CRA. Now, this is interesting because I've had discussions with people about this, like on Twitter and elsewhere, with regards to our coverage on the show about political activity being monitored from other charities in Canada. And the question is, well, you know, if I'm against that, then I should also be against the Fraser Institute being audited. Now, in an ironic sort of way, I'm not necessarily saying that I'm against having charities have this prohibition on political activity, and I think that the Fraser Institute should be free to do whatever they wish. The question, of course, is about the integrity of the CRA, if they're going to impose a certain level of responsibility on some charities, they should equally apply it to other charities. What's interesting is that the Fraser Institute has been doing essentially what environmental groups have been accused of doing. The Fraser Institute gets lots and lots of money from foreign investors like the Koch brothers, and they clearly have a political agenda. I mean, they're not hiding that at all. They clearly have one, which, again, is what environmental groups have been accused of doing, of taking in foreign money with a political agenda that they are breaking charity law. Now, if that's what environmental groups are doing, and also being labeled terrorists, then why isn't the Fraser Institute also falling under the microscope? Now, maybe one could argue that the Fraser Institute is somehow managing to walk that fine line, nonpartisan, non-political. But again, the organization engages in plenty of lobbying efforts. They've called on government to change election spending laws. They've pushed provinces to adopt a right-to-work legislation. So, I mean, again, it's clear that they're actually engaging in political activity. Where all these connections can get a bit disturbing, of course, is that the Koch brothers, their industry is based on oil and gas, and they've been known to sink in lots of money into advocacy groups across North America that have a political agenda against environmental groups, groups that are pro-business, that are pro-resource extraction. And it's a bit disturbing based on the fact that they're also linked to climate change denialism. They're linked to the Tea Party movement. So again, if they're funneling in money into the Fraser Institute, and the Fraser Institute is trying to influence Canadian policy, well, I mean, that's a pretty big red flag. And not that I'm suggesting that this needs to be illegal, but if the environmental charities are getting called terrorists and are being monitored by the RCMP and being investigated by the CRA, I don't know, shouldn't the Fraser Institute be, you know, on that list as well? I would argue that they should be. What do you think, listeners? Let us know. We'll be continuing to cover this ongoing issue with the CRA and charities and nonprofits and see where it leads us. Maybe the Fraser Institute is on the list and they have simply yet to be audited. So we'll have to see. We'll see where that goes and report back on it when news happens. Let's take a quick break here on The Sector, and we'll return after this.
become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the UBC and Kitsilano area at
The Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books and Sound, The Bike Kitchen, The Cove, Dentry's Pub, Displace Hashery, Limelight Video, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Bar and Grill, Lotusland Tattoo, Nuba Kitsilano, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends are for.
Beautiful country. You know, I rode out here about 50 years ago on a little dun horse and started a film career. Picture called The Big Trail. Well, I made quite a few since then. Some good, some bad. Matter of fact, in those days...
CITR!
Matter of fact, they come in pretty handy anytime. It's kind of nice to... know you have something set aside. So if you ever figure on that, remember that
CITR
can be mighty helpful.
Yeah!
And we're back on The Sector here on CITR with me, Ethan Clow. Well, we're going to take a quick musical interlude. So we're going to play a band that's been getting a lot of airtime here on CITR, and rightly so. This is Slow Learners with their song Telepath off their latest album, Grow On You.
All day.
And that was Slow Learners with their song Telepath off the album Grow On You. If you would like to find more songs that are popular on the CITR charts, check out CITR.ca for more awesome indie music. Well, getting back to the show, I mentioned at the start with talking about the Scottish referendum that we would talk a little bit about demographics. Now, recently, a new study came out talking about the role of demographics in the workplace of Canada. Workplace preferences of millennials and Gen X, attracting and retaining the 2020 workforce. So obviously, this is a really comprehensive report. It is done by the Conference Board of Canada, authors Nakiko Hawkins, Jane Vallon, and Ruth Wright. So really comprehensive report. We're not going to be able to go through all of it, obviously. But I thought there were some interesting findings that we could discuss here on the show. And again, I think this is relevant for a lot of the topics that we've come up with in the past. I mean, particularly with regards to workplace environments and also the changing face of giving in Canada and volunteering and what that means for nonprofits, social enterprises, and corporations going forward. What this report points to is that we have a cultural shift that's going on. A lot of the baby boomers are leaving the workplace, or they're nearing retirement, or they're nearing retirement, as it were. What we found is that because of the baby boomer demographic size and the way that it has influenced so many different jobs and so many different career opportunities and roles in work, that there's actually going to be a bit of a cultural shockwave that goes through between millennials and Gen X, who are not exactly going to be satisfied with the existing cultural structure that has been created by the baby boomer generation. Now, one of the things that's different, of course, is that Gen X and millennials, they tend to want more comprehensive advancements. They tend to have stronger expectations when it comes to career advancement. Now, one of the ways that this report is suggesting that we can deal with this in terms of keeping people happy and employed is to expose employees and other leaders to different parts of business. So as opposed to saying, you know, to someone, I'm going to promise you a promotion in 5 years, a promise you can't really fulfill, arrange so that this person, these younger generations, get an opportunity to move about through the job experience, try different things, gain different skill sets, and as opposed to like an upwards promotion, they can kind of move diagonally up, sideways and around, and it gets them a bigger perspective of the workplace environment. Now, of course, there are a lot of similarities, of course, between the generations. Both prefer leaders who are accessible and receptive to their ideas. That's a given. Career achievement is important, but nobody wants to really sacrifice their personal life anymore. And of course, everybody values money. Money is great. But the specific benefits tend to reflect people's different life stage. And again, I mean, this is sort of relevant to the Scottish question, where you have a group of people who are expecting to get pensions and coverage from a national healthcare service. They don't want to risk losing that compared to a generation that at this stage in their life are more concerned with, you know, getting a basic job. Now, the lifestyle question has always been an interesting one for demographic concerns. Both Gen X and millennials, well, they want to achieve really well in the workplace. They want to advance. They want to move themselves into executive positions. They're simply not willing to sacrifice life for work. This, of course, is a bit of a difference from the baby boomer generation, which was seen to be more of a get-it-done generation, whereas there was a notion that you went out, you worked hard, and you were there from 9 to 5 or, you know, 9 to 8, and you came home and then you had your life. Well, with the newer generations, that's changing considerably. And in order for organizations to retain employees, they need to find ways to adapt to this. So that's why we talked about before the notion of corporate social responsibility that involves their employees. Because again, this is a big way for a corporation to, you know, retain people because they feel like they're doing good, but it also gives them an outlet for ways to improve their social life, for ways to engage in non-work activities, while at the same time sort of engaging in work activities. So it's kind of a win-win. The question of remuneration is also interesting. In the report, millennials make it clear that they would switch employers if offered more money. Benefits in terms of health coverage and such are driven by life stage, so they're different, but only minorly different. Millennials show a preference for things like vision care and paternal leave, supplemented by pay. By contrast, Gen X prefers things like pension plans and prescription drug coverage. So again, I think it's really important that a corporation or a nonprofit wants to differentiate and provide options for things like benefits and salaries, so that depending on what your priorities are as, you know, an employee, you feel like it's being reflected in the organization that you work for. So, I mean, demonstrating flexibility and opportunity in that aspect is a win-win situation for the organization as well. Of course, this all begs the question, how different are the generations when it really comes down to it? I mean, both want to be, you know, rewarded for their work. They want a flexible environment. So, you know, how significant are these differences, and is it really backed up by the research? Now, in reading the report, it's actually quite clear that the researchers recognize this question, and they even say there really isn't any consensus on how important generational differences are. Researchers are disagreeing over significant generational differences in work styles and preferences. Some argue that factors like job level are more important in predicting work motivation than the generation itself. Indeed, in the research presented in the paper, they found that gender differences and work preferences are greater than generational differences in some cases, which, again, you know, that makes sense as well. The researchers looked at what percentage of millennials and Gen X view the importance of various work-related situations. So for work styles and environment, 34% of millennials considered that to be the most important aspect in, you know, a job. Whereas Gen X, 32% ranked that as the most important. So very close already. For opportunities for growth and development, 24% of millennials ranked that as one of the most important aspects, whereas 23% of Gen X. Again, very close. In terms of rewards and recognition, millennials ranked it 17%, saying it's the most important thing. For Gen X, it was 14%. So that's a real first major change in terms of views between Gen X and millennials, rewards and recognition. In terms of organizational culture and values, 10% of millennials ranked that as the most important, 9% of Gen X. In terms of leadership and management, 9% in millennials and 17% in Gen X. Again, the other sort of big change between Gen X and millennials. Again, and ironically, those are the leadership and management and rewards and recognition are really the only two areas where millennials and Gen X differ radically in how they rank the importance of various work-related aspects. This would suggest that some of the stereotypes about the differences between millennials and Gen X and baby boomers might be a bit exaggerated, which I would suspect are true. Some of these stereotypes can be explained with the research that is presented in the article. For example, we often think of millennials as being a bit overambitious in terms of desiring advancement and promotions. But those between the ages of 20 and 30 who are usually just entering the workforce are often concerned with advancement and acquiring new skills. So as a result, millennials who are currently in that age group are often perceived as being naive or overambitious. But again, the research seems to suggest that as millennials approach the 30s and 40s, they're going to start demonstrating the same characteristics as Gen X. So the stereotypes may not exactly be all that true. They may in fact be circumstantial at best. And another way that stereotypes can sort of become real is that the social construction of the workplace may in fact be based on a stereotype which provokes reaction, which actually causes the stereotype to occur. So for instance, millennials may be assumed to be, you know, naturally better at using technology and other social media. So managers may put them in charge of technology and social media and related fields and put them in sort of a collaborative work environment because they assume that millennials prefer that. And so basically, because people believe in this generational difference, it becomes real and meaningful because millennials end up working in those environments because they're told to, and the prophecy sort of fulfills itself. And it's interesting to sort of run down the list of stereotypes for millennials and Gen Xers. You know, millennials are considered to be optimistic, trusting, team players, a bit sheltered, confident, accepting of authority, ambitious, civic-minded, whereas Gen X is considered to be a bit cynical, distrusting, independent, you know, bearing the weight of the world, a bit fearful, a bit mocking, underachieving, politically disengaged. And I think that most of these stereotypes aren't really all that research-focused. They're probably more likely based on circumstantial evidence and not really scientifically informed. What's interesting is looking at some of the profiles that the researchers did for this report. In terms of education, which is also interesting in terms of perceptions about Gen X and millennials in society. So for instance, for millennials, the highest percentage of the surveyed millennials, 34% have an undergraduate degree, whereas 28% of Generation X has the same, an undergraduate degree. Now, again, that's sort of ironic in some respects because of the perception that millennials, you know, they get their BA or whatever in art history and try to go into the business world and get promoted, you know, after their first day. So, again, maybe a grain of truth in that matter, but it's not much higher than the 28% of Gen Xers who also have their undergraduate degree. For the next sort of levels up in terms of education, like, for example, some postgraduate work or no master's degree, both are about 5%. There is a slight difference in terms of master's degree, with only 11% of millennials having one, whereas 14% of Gen X does. In terms of a postgraduate certificate, we're looking at about 2% for millennials, 5% for Gen X, so a bit more there is on the Gen X side. And a doctorate is actually very close at 2% for millennials and 2.9% for Gen X. So both generations, not many doctors amongst them. And of course, like, how does this impact workforce experience? Well, in terms of total years in the workforce full-time as a percentage, millennials are all over the map in terms of where they fall on this. Whereas Generation X, far more weighted towards the longer periods. So 16 years or more, 72% of Gen Xers fall into that category. 11 to 15 years working full-time, 22% of Gen Xers fall into that category. And then it gets progressively smaller for Gen X. For millennials, less than 2 years in the workplace full-time, 9%. 3 to 5, 18%. 6 to 10 years in the workforce, 44%. 11 to 15, 23, and 16 or more, only 3. So the bulk of millennial experience in the workforce is somewhere between 6 to 15 years. So not a huge length of time. But again, it's not like the majority of them have been only working for a few years. They've actually, a sizable percentage of them, more so than Gen X, have put in 11 to 15 years. Meaning that that's not really like out of the question to be expecting promotions or raises or increased responsibility, which are hallmarks of the millennial generation. So some of the conclusions that the researchers have come to based on the statistics is that millennials are as satisfied and loyal as Gen X in their jobs. So this kind of busts the myth that millennials are not as loyal or are dissatisfied with their jobs in Gen X. Millennials are often portrayed as, you know, unsatisfied job hoppers, but the evidence is a far more nuanced situation. Although some research finds that millennials have lower job satisfaction than older generations, others indeed find the opposite. Indeed, the research suggests that about 3/4 of both millennials and Gen X are either very satisfied or satisfied with their jobs. Now, an interesting way to kind of tie this back to the nonprofit sector, as the sector grows and as different jobs emerge, and as the charities and the nonprofits themselves get larger and are able to employ more people, we're starting to see this reflected in the social sector of the nonprofit world. You know, it's not simply a question of having a couple of fundraisers and like a manager and executive director. Now we're seeing a whole new wide range of people working in the nonprofit and social enterprise realm. And one of the last points that I wanted to make regarding this research is this notion of the work-life balance. And this is something that pops up a lot in sociology, as well as in any kind of discussion about the sort of the millennial Gen X, you know, question compared to the baby boomers, et cetera, is about that, you know, millennials want to have, 8 weeks of paid vacation time and this elaborate medical coverage and, you know, relaxed work environments and blah, 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 blah. The reality, of course, is that it's not simply a question of millennials who want this kind of work-life balance. Everybody wants a work-life balance. Some of the research that they found has indicated that employees resent being asked to sacrifice life for work. Instead, everybody wants to have a reasonable balance. Both generations desire flexible work schedules, work arrangements. About one-third of respondents included that their definition of an ideal work-life imbalance includes sort of this ability to create a schedule that works for you around your life. Both desire a clear separation between work and life and a predictable schedule. So people don't want to bring their work home with them. And again, I mean, is that all that different from the baby boomers? I don't know. The evidence for this is really excellent here in the report. They looked at the hours actually worked of millennials and Gen X, and then they looked at the preferred hours worked for millennials and Gen X. So for instance, for clerical, production, maintenance, service, sales jobs, hours actually worked for millennials was about 38.9. For Gen X, it was about 39. So again, very small difference there. When they looked at the preferred hours worked, for millennials it was 35, for Gen X it was 35. Exactly the same. So, you know, it's not like there's this huge discrepancy between millennials. They only want to work 10 hours a week or something. It in fact shows that both have the same ambitions to work as hard. Both simply want the work-life balance that everybody craves. And we've talked about how important this balance is in the workplace today. And again, this applies to the for-profit world, but also to the nonprofit world. And I think the nonprofit world has an opportunity to have a real advantage in this case, because there's the one benefit that the nonprofit world has the opportunity to say, look, when you work here, you can, you know, get up in the morning, look at yourself in the face and say, hey, I don't work for Big Oil or, you know, a company that sells useless products. We work in an environment that allows us to change things, to advise policy and make the world a better place. And that's, you know, really wonderful. That's an awesome opportunity. So that's one tick that the nonprofit sector has. And when you factor in sort of the work-life balance, there's another great opportunity there, because the nonprofit sector naturally lends itself to volunteering and getting involved in the community. And that, more often than not, I would say, has the opportunity to be a fun experience, a fun social experience. It doesn't have to be picking up trash on a highway. It can be getting out there, whether you're fundraising, whether you're doing a company picnic style event. It can be so many different options. And the nonprofit world, it just lends itself naturally to that kind of social engagement. And, you know, why wouldn't you want that? So a huge advantage there for the nonprofit sector. There's really no excuse for us to be losing, you know, good workers to the for-profit sector when we could have a really healthy nonprofit sector, you know, with a social enterprise component. So then all that remains for the nonprofit sector then is to make sure that we're paying our employees a healthy wage so that we don't lose them to the for-profit world, as someone like Dan Pallotta would suggest. Well, why don't we just take a quick break here on the sector, and we'll return after it to wrap up the show for another week.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective. News 101 is Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced student and community newscast, bringing you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective. Tune in Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Live streaming and podcasts are available online at citr.ca.
Class, shut up! Shut up and listen to me right now. This is Fred Schneider, and you're listening to CITR. Shut up and listen to this radio station.
And we're back on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, discussing nonprofit social justice and activism. We've just been going over the interesting question of workplace differences between the generations of the millennials and the Gen Xers. And we've been looking at a report done by the Conference Board of Canada outlining some of the differences and some of the findings and how those findings actually compare to some of the stereotypes that we've talked about previously on the show. So very interesting stuff. I'd like to hear your feedback when it comes to the generational differences that you've experienced in the workplace, or, you know, what they mean to you as a millennial or a Gen Xer or a baby boomer or of the civic generation, which is the generation before the baby boomers. So let us know what your thoughts are on this. Of course, you can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. Of course, you can find us online at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, where you can also download the podcast and get the show notes to make sure that we're, you know, actually talking about real stuff. That's really important. And of course, follow us on Twitter at Sector Podcast and at Ethan Clow. And we're also on Facebook. So many ways to interact with us, which is always good. Well, we have reached the end of yet another show here on CITR. So thank you all for tuning in and checking out The Sector. We'll be back next week with another new episode. And until then, this is Ethan Clow, your host, saying thanks for listening and see you next week.